I'm Kevin Berg. I am a GIS epidemiologist. I actually work on Colorado's environmental public health tracking program. Just before I start showing you a bunch of maps, I want to situate everybody to the context before we start looking at a weird panhandle-shaped county. But this is the study area is the city and county of Denver and the immediately surrounding areas. And so the central question of this research project is how best to map childhood lead poisoning risk. And so basically, if you look at the newspaper or research literature, you'll see two common types of childhood lead poisoning risk maps. And so the first type is a map of risk factors. And as probably most of you know, those risk factors are some kind of measure of housing age and poverty rate in different areas, and probably some others from I'm a social scientist, so some other environmental risk factors, too. But a common strategy would be to create an index to represent both of these risk factors in one measure. And then typically you'll see folks will map this at some kind of census geography, like a census tract, county, that type of thing. So the first example comes to us from our friends at Washington State's lead program, I believe, who developed a methodology for creating an index of housing and poverty variables. And if their methodology was taken up by the website Vox, who then developed a national census tract level map, which is pretty cool, of this index. And so basically it is a weighted index of housing age by age group from the census and poverty rate at the census tract level. And they calculated some z-scores and added these two things together, and then they divided it up into deciles. And so that's what gives you the 10, the 1 through 10 index. So hopefully, obviously, the dark red is 10, and that's the highest risk, and the dark blue is 1, and that's the lowest risk. And so another thing I want to point out is that hopefully you can see in purple, those are the 5 targeted zip codes that are listed in Colorado state regs for targeting our at-risk population. So Colorado is a targeted lead screening state. We're not a universal screening state. And basically, to simplify a great deal, we target low-income children. And so the second type of map that you will commonly see are maps of blood lead test results. And so a common strategy will be to find some way to deduplicate so that you have one unique test that you're treating as the final test per child and confirm that blood lead level. And then geocode that to the residential location of the child. And then a lot of times you'll see the researchers will aggregate elevated test results to a census geography and then use some kind of denominator. So another example of that I created here. So this is using our elevated blood lead cases from 2010 to 2014. And then the denominator I chose is the number of children under 6 living in poverty from the 2010 to 14 American Community Survey. So this is a presentation about how I don't want people to do this because I'm a geographer and I'm going to tell you how to map it correctly. So I'm going to go ahead and say that I don't like this map. But in fact, most GIS-based analysis of blood lead level test results will aggregate EBL cases to census geographies. And there's a couple of good reasons for this. Namely, as we saw, the denominator data is there and the risk factor data is there. And then occasionally, policies will be implemented at this level so it can make sense to do that as well. But there are a number of issues with aggregating cases to census geographies that I would like to point out. So, this is my catchy title. These are some of the pitfalls of case aggregation. So there's probably a few more, but most of them have to do with whether or not there's some type of mismatch between the numerator and denominator, and whether your denominator population is capturing the same people or the people you're interested in. And whether or not the time periods match up, which can be a problem with the census data. But another sort of poorly recognized issue is with the census tract level data from the American Community Survey. And some of the undersampled populations which would be children under six living in poverty, some of those tract level estimates can have pretty high margins of error, and so are may or may not be reliable. So you also lose spatial specificity when you aggregate cases to census geographies, which is important for lead poisoning, because the whole idea of mapping lead poisoning risk is so we can target resources. And so another more sinister technical problem is the modifiable aerial unit problem, which is a pretty well-studied problem in quantitative geography. But essentially what we're doing when we aggregate cases to census geographies is that we're drawing arbitrary boundaries around the spatial locations of those cases. And so some pretty well-known studies in quantitative geography have pointed out that you can go from a positive to a negative correlation if you're analyzing some kind of relationship just by aggregating the same data to different spatial scales. So the point is that all of these can lead to mischaracterization of the spatial patterns of risk. And so to avoid those issues, I analyzed the point-level blood lead testing data that we collected the state, and then as part of our participation in the Colorado and the National Environmental Public Health Tracking Network, this data was cleaned and confirmed using those methods. And those methods rely on having multiple or subsequent testing data in order to confirm an elevated blood lead level. So one thing you'll notice about this graph is that the gray is our a proportion of unconfirmed blood lead levels, and the blue is confirmed. And so a great deal of ours are not able to be confirmed because they either don't have a subsequent test or they didn't have it within the window defined by the tracking program. So I point this out because the results presented here are for all elevated test results, with the idea that that's going to be more conservative. But I also did the analysis with the confirmed only, and the results are pretty consistent. So the type of study design I used to analyze this data is a spatial case control study, which is a common study design in geographic epidemiology. The cases here are residential locations of children under six. Of children under six with blood lead levels greater than or equal to 5 micrograms per deciliter. And it's all the pooled data from 2010 to 2014. And so a key assumption of spatial case control studies is that your control population needs to be representative of the underlying natural spatial variation of your at-risk population. And so in a spatial case control study, we test for two distinct but related research questions, which is that the first one is whether or not there's global spatial clustering, and then you can also use these tests to identify local spatial clusters. And so that kind of translates into the two research questions at the top and the bottom. But basically, clustering is whether our cases are clustering in general throughout the study area over and above the underlying population distribution or density of the at-risk population. And then the question of whether there are clusters is, that tells us as if there are specific locations that are smaller in area within the study area that are generating more cases than would be expected just based on where the at-risk population is living. And so a little bit more on our control population. So the controls were drawn actually from our blood lead level test results that were either negative or below detectable levels. And so to sort of ensure consistent statistical power from year over year to year, we randomly selected the controls so that we would have an approximate 6-to-1 control to case ratio. The controls were randomly selected after ordering by latitude and longitude, which helps to ensure the spatial representativeness of the control population. But essentially, in order to kind of comply with the assumptions of a spatial case control study, controls were chosen to represent cases spatially and temporally, and temporally in that we select controls from the same year that we have the cases. So if your cases are from 2010, the controls are from 2010. And then finally, because Colorado is a targeted screening state, the second assumption is that they have relatively similar distributions of socioeconomic status, and that's because they're being brought into our testing program. So I used two different methods to analyze the spatial case control data set. And I'm only going to talk about one of them because I don't have time. But a common technique in these types of studies is you test for global spatial clustering. And the K function, which is grayed out there, is a test for that. But I'm going to talk a little bit more about kernel density estimation. And so throughout answering each of these questions of whether there's clustering or local spatial clusters, the null and alternative hypotheses are pretty consistent. So the null hypothesis is that of constant risk across space after adjusting for the population, for the underlying population density of the at-risk population. Is there something else I wanted to say about that? No. Okay. The alternative hypothesis is that of heterogeneous risk. And so if that's true, then there are some areas in the study area that are, again, they're generating more cases than would be expected based on the at-risk population density. So I did want to say something about the null hypothesis. So in these spatial methods, you would assume that your case rate is just going to follow where I'm going to probably say this a million times, but it's going to follow where your at-risk population density is highest. And so if you're just getting more cases where your population density is highest for your at-risk population, then you don't really need to worry about mapping cases. Or necessarily. But anyway, moving forward. So, kernel density estimation. And so if you're somewhat familiar with multivariate statistics, it's essentially just a bivariate probability density function. If you're not familiar with multivariate statistics, you can just imagine a three-dimensional normal curve that kind of moves around the study area. And so the type or shape of the kernel function, which is sort of the arc shape on the left there, it's not very influential, and most people just use basically what would be a three-dimensional normal curve. However, the bandwidth or the radius of that kernel is what's can influence the study results. And so if you choose a bandwidth that's too small, what you'll do is you'll just pick up a lot of noise in the study area, and it'll look like you have a bunch of clusters of risk when you're just kind of picking up noise. But alternatively, if you choose a bandwidth that's too big, that will over-smooth the data and kind of smooth out any relevant things that you might be interested in. And so in kernel density estimation, you can have a fixed bandwidth, which is you use some method to choose an optimal bandwidth for, that's one bandwidth for the whole study area. Or you can do adaptive bandwidth. And so with adaptive bandwidth, your bandwidth size just changes with the amount of underlying data that's present in the study area. So in areas where there's high population density, you'll have a smaller bandwidth. And where there's low population density, the bandwidth will expand. And so this study actually uses adaptive bandwidth kernel density estimation, and that is because it's thought to reduce the bias that's present in a fixed situation. So essentially the way kernel density estimation works is that you overlay a fine rectangular or square grid with a bunch of cells over your study area, and your kernel function visits each cell to calculate point density at that cell. And so density at the grid cell is affected by the number of points that are inside the bandwidth, the spatial distribution of those points within that kernel, as well as the size of the bandwidth, as I mentioned. And then there's an edge correction, which if you notice where the kernel kind of gets out on the edge of the study area, that's just to reduce the bias at the end. And it's basically just how much of the kernel is actually inside the study area. And so it moves around the study area and produces this sort of density heat map, weather map kind of looking thing on the right there. So again, I used adaptive bandwidth kernel density estimation. So there's a lot going on here. But on the left, we do the kernel density estimation for cases and controls separately to start off with. And so on the left we have case density, and on the right we have control density. And so hopefully you can also see there's some red contour lines around those hotspots. And so those are the 90th percentile contours of density. And so inside of those contours is where the highest concentrations of both case and control densities are located. And so already just kind of visually inspecting these patterns, we can see that they're a little bit different in some places, and some places they overlap. But the idea here is that we're going to use statistical methods to tell us exactly in how much and how significant these patterns are distinct. And so one other thing I want to point out, just a bit of evidence to support that our control population is satisfying some of the assumptions of the study design. You cannot see that at all, but I overlaid some more lines on there. And so there's some green lines now on top of the red lines on the control density. And so I did kernel density estimation with tract level data of children under six living in poverty. And so what I'm trying to point out here is that and inside of those green contours is the highest density of that estimate. And so they're largely consistent, which is showing some bit of evidence that our control population is reflecting our at-risk population. So the statistic that we use to compare the case densities and control densities is a spatially adaptive risk function. Some people call it a relative risk function, but it's basically an odds ratio. If you hear me calling it a relative risk function, you feel very strongly about me not calling it a relative risk function, you can just point it out, and I'll stop. But anyway, it's calculated as, it's basically a ratio of case to control densities, and it compares the spatial distributions of cases and controls. And so we had some hotspots in the last map, and I'm going to show you a further map that has hotspots. But in this case, the hotspots are local areas of elevated risk where there are more cases being generated than what would be expected from the control population. So a couple of things to point out here, which you also cannot see very clearly. So this is the results of the spatially adaptive risk function. And I'm going to compare this to the case density to kind of talk about some of the differences. But basically, just right off the bat, we can see that the risk of having an elevated blood lead level is not constant throughout the Denver metro area after you adjust for where the underlying at-risk population is living. And so there are contour lines on this map that you can't really see very well. But basically, the odds ratio ranges from just over zero to almost eight. And so the red areas range approximately have an odds ratio of approximately two to about eight. And so that tells us that within those areas, the risk of it having an elevated blood lead level is between two and eight times greater than in other parts of the study area. So this map is actually mapped on using the same techniques and scale so that it can be comparable to the case and control densities. I went too far. So we can also assess the statistical significance, which just allows us to draw some other lines around those clusters. But if you can't see it very well, the green lines are the significant clusters of elevated risk, and that's at the 95% confidence level. So again, that last map was mapped on the same scale as the case and control densities, but a better way to color that map is just to map it by equal areas of the odds ratio. Equal areas of risk. And so hopefully you can see this a little better. Those are the lines of statistical significance. But at this point, I need to start talking about what the difference between case density and spatial risk is. And so if we compare the distributions, if you see that contour line that's on that sort of the outermost contour line, that is the line of where the odds ratio is greater. Inside of that is where the odds ratio is greater than one. So it has elevated risk. And so if you're comparing just the areas of elevated risk to the case density, you can see that they're largely consistent. However, there is this place sort of on the western portion of the study area where we have high case density outside of where the risk model is telling us where our elevated risk is. It's important to point out that these methods were developed to study cancer clusters. And so with cancer, I'm not a cancer epidemiologist, but there's a certain amount of background morbidity that's sort of inevitable because of the spatial distributions of different genetic conditions or different age groups. And so there's some sense of there being underlying morbidity that's kind of inevitable. But with lead poisoning, childhood lead poisoning in particular, that's not the case. So we're still, what I'm trying to say is that we're still interested in where our highest densities of just the cases are, and not necessarily places where there are more cases than expected. But what risk can tell us is, or what spatial risk functions do for us, is they have certain statistical properties that can be useful, and we can build models to model what is driving those spatial patterns of risk. And so that can be used to target different risk factors and assess them for how strongly they're driving this pattern. So just to kind of bring this all together, and so we started off with this map of census environmental risk factors of poverty and housing age. And so then we were able to use this method to look at where we're actually getting our highest density of children with elevated blood lead above 5 micrograms per deciliter. And so already, hopefully, although the colors are kind of blending together for me, you can see that our targeted zip codes, our area of 5 targeted zip codes, is completely missing this area in the eastern part of the study area. And it's also not picking up some of the finer scale places outside of those zip codes. So then when you overlay risk, what you can see from here is that the risk of having an elevated blood lead isn't just something that we can map at a census tract level and say the risk is there and it's constant within that census tract. In fact, it actually varies within a lot of census tracts. And that's because of population patterns, but it's also probably most likely due to currently unmeasured but spatially varying risk factors that we can then use this risk function to build statistical models to tell us something about those risk factors. And so again, there's, just to make it even harder to look at, there's the statistical significance of those clusters of elevated risk. And so a couple of concluding items. And so the title of my project is What's in the Aggregate? And so the answer is that spatial specificity matters and that risk varies within geographic areas. And so we avoided some of the technical pitfalls of aggregation. But the most important part is that we have address level data and it has these fine scale spatial signals in it, and we can use that information. And in particular, in the case of childhood lead poisoning, we should be using that information because typically we expect the exposure to happen in or near the home. And so we can also use these methods to target scarce public health dollars in a more spatially efficient manner. So some future work ideas. We're definitely looking right now at adding zip codes to our targeted screening areas and using some of these methods to do that. We also want to expand this analysis to basically all of the front range of Colorado, which is basically the part that's immediately east of the Rocky Mountains and where the highest population density of Colorado is. But we can basically expand these methods to wherever we have sufficient blood lead screening data. So we also want to start using, as I mentioned, the spatial risk function and the statistical properties of that to evaluate different exposure sources so that we can inform mitigation efforts. And so one more point is we could use this spatial case control methodology to, if it's set up in a slightly different way, to evaluate the performance of our screening program statewide. And so we could do that if we have a control population that we could map throughout the whole state, which an example of that would be if we could get all of the address information of children enrolled in Medicaid and then map that, we could select a control population. And then we could do this analysis with all of the test data and find out where we have, so this method can not only be used to locate elevated areas, but it'll also tell you where there's less tests than would be expected from the at-risk population. So that's it.
Get tested, get
So the essential idea is that, I mean, it's not a sample, right? We're pooling data for 5 years. And with a spatial case control study, the most important assumption that you satisfy is that you have spatial representativeness of both the at-risk population and your cases. And so I'm trying to make an argument that this is something that could be used. You couldn't do it for just 1 year, but we're pooling we get all of the test data. We are using both venous and capillary data. And so in some ways it's kind of the best we can do, but if I'm open. Yes, and so, so I guess that is an excellent point, but something we are going to look at in the future, and when we start to build statistical models to explain the risk function, so that's a non-parametric method. It's not really adjusted for anything, but when you start to build statistical models, we could actually throw in that kind of information at the ecologic level. So if there are places with lots of migrant populations or different, if we're using demographic characteristics of neighborhoods on the ecological level as a proxy for that kind of thing. I mean, I'm not saying it's perfect, but you could start to try to find ways to control for that without necessarily going through, 20,000 elevated blood lead levels to find, we are starting to also do some home investigations and collect the information about sources, but it's definitely not at the level that we could use it to compare on the same scale. But it's probably a long ways off from being able to actually use in some kind of large-scale model like this.
So I've been debating what math I can use for a program. I currently have an ASLA project, and so I'm doing some GIS mapping and looking at lead risk. And I was debating using lead poisoning and screening because we have 92 counties. Mm-hmm. And even with aggregating our data, we still have less than 100 kids that are tested. That county, and so just using the risk without the lead poisoning, we can zoom in and identify. For example, we found a census tract that had high housing, high order housing, high poverty, and also there was a military base too. And so then we went in and added the lead poisoning kids, and we can look and see that relationship where there's three threats to that child's lead poisoning. So I would kind of be wary. Like, you almost have to use multiple maps to assess risk.
You're going to have to repeat the question or the answer because the room can't hear.
Yeah. I don't know if I can.
Sorry. So I'm actually working on an ASLO project right now looking at GIS mapping at the sub-county level. And so I've been constantly debating, do I want to add a weight from lead poisoning, our lead poisoning rates, Do I just want to look at the risk factors for lead poisoning, such as older housing and poverty? Or, you know, do I want to create multiple maps that include all those factors? Because one of the examples we found by just looking at one of the census tracts where we had these two high risk factors, they also were military-based, so there's occupational exposures as well. And then we added the lead poisoning data, and we could see that there's a small pocket. Although we only have a small pocket of kids that are lead poisoning, we don't have a lot of lead poisoning screenings. So we're going to be targeting that area to try and increase screening to identify, you know, these high lead levels in those kids. So I don't know. I just think that's something to consider, is using a variety of maps to try to, not just one set of model.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's really important. And I guess the risk factor map, I think, is a really great technique. And it's also, I mean, the more layers and the more maps that you can put onto the same place, and then we're starting to build, these statistical models using generalized additive models, which is basically just a way to make the same kind of risk map that you saw, but then we can add explanatory variables in an exploratory way, not necessarily in a truly causal analysis kind of way. But we can do these large-scale exploratory analyses basically throughout the whole state. So I would agree with you that, adding the more data that you can add to that, the better, in terms of doing sort of large-scale exploratory analysis. Oh, you here.
So I think kind of what we're getting at is for the area where some of the rural areas we don't have much testing, and some of that risk factor mapping is more useful and better to show. So I was wondering what you said you wanted to expand this where you had enough testing. What kind of would you say is like a threshold for the number of tests to do this kind of analysis?
So that's a good question. So the way that we kind of chose to start this analysis in the Denver metro area is that after 2012, when CDC changed its reference level, we continued to get a really consistent number of tests from this area that were both elevated and just the number of total tests. And so, I mean, we're just kind of trying to pool as much data and trying to be, careful, but I don't have a way to say that this is an optimal number of tests to use. But my point at the end about using this kernel density estimation and spatial risk function is that if you have a control population, which we use our test data, so that's not going to be representative in places where there's no tests. But if you could map all children, and we're a targeted state, so if you map all children enrolled in Medicaid, with the same age groups, with a consistent time period, then you can use these methods to say, well, and just using the test points, so not just the elevated, but if you just use all the points, unique tests in your data set, then you could start to say, well, this area over here has a statistically significantly lower number of tests than are expected from the underlying at-risk population.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment that this session was organized to really get the dialogue going about lead and in light of Flint, and to highlight some of the gaps in our data. I think not understanding what targeted testing versus universal testing and how that varies by areas, and how your data, when you don't have universal testing, it's really tough to say how one area compares to another. It's just really hard to do that. But I was going to ask Martha and anybody else here in the room if they wanted to comment about what they've learned from lead in their area, given the situation in Flint. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, and I know you may not be able to say a lot, but I know you've been thinking about it.
So. Well, I was trying to avoid being asked that question.
You knew I was going to ask that question.
I did?
So why don't you come to the mic?
Okay. Well, I think the lead program, the surveillance part of CLIP, was moved out of maternal child health in our department after the Flint business blew up, was moved from maternal child health to environmental health into my surveillance, environmental surveillance program. We also have a tracking program and some other things. And I knew a little bit about lead surveillance because I'd been involved in adult blood lead surveillance issues in the occupational realm. But the first thing was my learning curve was so steep. I mean, it is so complex, all the different aspects of lead surveillance. And our lead surveillance system, it links to Medicaid. There's an upload into our immunization registry. There's issues of case management at the local health department level. And there's actually two databases. One is used by the local health departments and one is used at the state level. And then there's getting all the labs to report. And there's trying to get all the labs to start reporting using HL7 through our data gateway. And so, I mean, it's just really complicated. And so one of the things that that we're doing is probably going to bring in a consultant to look at the whole work process flow to try and get some more efficiencies and understand better how we can meet the needs of all the people that are asking for this. And another thing that we did starting in February, we actually started systematically tracking all of the requests we've had for lead data from researchers, from local health departments, from citizens who have some issue or whatever. And I mean, we're like up to, I don't know, 130 or 140. We have researchers wanting our data and wanting, you know, PHI data. And meaning going through IRB, and they don't understand why they can't just have zip code level or address level. So I guess I'm just saying it's really complex. And you know, in the old days, I mean, there were two people basically running the surveillance program, and they were kind of limping by, and there wasn't a whole lot of interest. And now all of a sudden, the whole world is moving. So it feels it's really been a challenge. Fortunately, we've been given some funding to hire some additional data epidemiology people. And then 2 weeks ago, I was told that the rest of the CLIP program was getting moved under me, the education outreach part of it. I just been doing the surveillance part of it. But you know, so I'll just make one comment. Water testing. Somebody brought up, are you testing water? You asked that question. I don't know if any of the lead programs across the country were doing any kind of systematic lead testing. In water. And now everybody's saying, is it the water? And should we be testing? We have other communities with higher percent of EDLs than Flint, much higher. And so all of the scrutiny is pretty overwhelming. I would be really interested in knowing, for those of you in your lead surveillance programs in your state, how the attention to Flint has changed your, you know, how you've been doing things, more data requests or water testing or whatever. So.
Yes.
I'll just say that in Alaska here, in reaction to Flint, there's definitely been more of a focus on the water issue. So kind of just in our little office, when we call up elevated blood lead level families, we are asking about their water source, which we should have been before, but we weren't. So that's just kind of a little change. And then also maybe kind of a greater collaboration is we're now working with our Department of Environmental Conservation. They have a water quality program, and they routinely have to test water around the state. And so for their water systems that are the oldest, where they have found lead in the water system, our public health nurses have gone to a couple of these communities so far to collect blood lead levels from the families there. And so that, I think, was a collaboration that was spawned by the attention to Flint. So I think it's been, you know, the attention has been, it's an unfortunate, obviously, scenario, but the attention has been good in some ways.
Other comments for
it's actually kind of nice to hear you say all of the issues that you're having with, I mean, as hard as the issues are with all of getting the lab certificate, their letters of 7, all of these different components and challenges that along with the lab program is actually reassuring. We, like I said a moment ago in Colorado, we just received our funding in 2014 and we're having all of these exact issues. But, I mean, it's terrible as to what is going on.
Andy. I mean, I'll just make some comments and I'll share anything. But I mean, one thing to think about is a childhood lead program is designed around pain as a risk factor. The choice of the age at which kids are tested is when they're crawling around on the ground, putting a lot of stuff in their mouth. The highest risk of water consumption is under the 9 months of age, when they're, especially the targeted families who are using dry formula and mix it, so they have a much higher content lead intake from water than a 2-year-old does. So part of it is how do you analyze your data, and then how do you account in a 9-month-old for those who are all being breastfed, who are the only lead source. So how to analyze your data if you don't have those risk factors is really one of the challenges that we're looking at is can we sort that out and we have to go back to doing the other things. And then the other one case that we worked on is looking at lead isotopes. You really want to spend a lot of money quickly. Have your blood samples done and then match it. And we got one child who did this because the adult or the parent had a blood, 300 blood lead from a bullet. His blood matched the bullet, which matches some ammunition manufactured in the U.S. So there's fascinating things if you look at isotope ratios of lead. Child at 10 didn't match the pain, didn't match the water, didn't match the fight. We don't have methods to how to account for those things. It wasn't all a lead in the lead or a house, but a door had a different pattern than the lead paint. So where the lead's coming from is quite problematic, but you could rule out a child didn't get the blood lead from the bullet. So it is a real challenge to how do we take our existing data and now try to account for some water.
Other experts, were you involved?
Yeah, I think also in Wisconsin.
Oh.
important thing would be to consider this more as a data mining technique, not necessarily, you know, it's just a way to get some kind of signal from your whole set of data that you have.
But your monitor is
definitely, yeah, but it's definitely something that's interesting.
I think we've got about 1 minute. Let's like in Flint be able to figure out where the lead lines were in the street and go into the house, they're still working. So, yeah. You know,
yeah, we can.
Well, I think they kind of found, they finally
got it. 13,000 miles per
you know. Just any more, anybody have a concluding remark?
Thank you.
Thanks to all the presenters.